Welcome to NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John. 150 years ago this month, one of the most noteworthy and disturbing events in Minnesota history took place, the hanging of 38 Dakota men in Mankato, the largest mass execution in U.S. history. The hangings on December 26, 1862, were an exclamation point on the U.S.-Dakota War, long known as the Sioux Uprising that raged that summer in the Minnesota River Valley. It was one of the major events in the Plains Indian Wars. The death toll was higher than Little Bighorn or Wounded Knee. Hundreds, perhaps 1,000 people died in the war, most of them white settlers. The government's response to the war included the expulsion of the Dakota people from the state under conditions that caused hundreds of Dakota to lose their lives. During this anniversary year, we've looked at the events of 1862 from a variety of angles. This hour, we hear the story from the perspective of a Mankato native, longtime public radio producer John Bewin. John worked for Minnesota Public Radio for many years, though he grew up in Mankato. He heard next to nothing about the U.S. Dakota War in his childhood there. Today, John directs the audio program at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University in North Carolina. Over the past year, John traveled southern Minnesota to places where key events occurred so he could explore what happened in all its complexity. He also looks at the shifting ways in which Minnesotans have told themselves the story of the Dakota War over the years, or have not. Little War on the Prairie was adapted from a story John Bewin originally reported for the public radio program This American Life.
In setting out to understand what happened in southern Minnesota in 1862, I called up Gwen Westerman. She agreed to spend a few days with me driving around the state to the spots where it all occurred so I could tell the story here on the radio. We meet up in Mankato. I grew up there but haven't lived there for 30 years. She's lived and taught there for the last 20 years.
More people probably know about the town of Mankato than realize it.
That's us, in Gwen's SUV.
Because in the television series Little House on the Prairie, the Ingalls family lived in Walnut Grove, and whenever Ma and Pa wanted to get away from the kids, they came to Mankato.
Gwen's an English professor at Minnesota State University in Mankato and a member of the Dakota tribe. She's in her 50s like me. She grew up in Kansas, part of the Dakota diaspora. A lot of her family was banished from Minnesota after the 1862 war. Not that she's always known that herself. See, I grew up in Mankato, a white kid, knowing next to nothing about the bloody history that happened beneath my feet. Gwen got a teaching job and moved to Mankato, also knowing nothing about that history. She found out later that some older people in her family did know.
And when I took the job here at MSU, my father and my uncle would say, we'll see how long you last there. But they never did explain why they had questions about whether I would stay here or not. So, December 26, 1993, I had a friend who worked at the university, and she said, there are Indians coming. She was also Indian. She said, there are Indians coming. Let's go see what they're doing.
That's all she said?
That's all she said. So I said, okay. She came and picked me up.
Gwen didn't know it, but she and her friend Kimberly were going to see the annual ceremony for the Dakota men who were hanged in the town square in 1862. They arrived late for the ceremony and stood in the back for the prayers and songs. They still didn't know what the event was about. And then it was over.
Kimberly and I got back in the car, and she was driving. And she started to pull around the corner of the building. And I don't know if your parents drove fast on backcountry roads when you were small, up and down the hills. We used to love it when my parents would do that, because you'd go over the top of the hill and then your stomach would kind of come up. But as we rounded the corner of the building, my stomach came up just like that. And I started to sob. And Kimberly stopped the car and said, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And I told her I had no idea what was wrong. It was incredible sadness. I didn't really say anything to anybody about that until a few days later when I called my uncle and explained to him what had happened. And after I finished my story, he was quiet for a long time. Then he finally said, "Well, my girl, you're connected to that place. You are physically and spiritually connected to that place."
Come on. That's crazy, man.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, how do you explain it? I didn't know what had happened here.
After that, she learned all about it. How the Dakota chief who led the uprising in 1862, Little Crow, was the brother of her great-great-great-great-grandmother. Another relative, Mazamani, was killed in the last battle of the war. Now she's so steeped in it, she co-wrote a book about the history of the Dakota people in Minnesota.
Oh, the sign is faded. Historic site to the right.
On a gravel farm road an hour and a half from Mankato, there's an oddly placed historic marker.
Here?
To find it, you have to pull into somebody's driveway. The yard is sheltered by pine trees.
We've driven onto a farm site with a classic weathered red barn and outbuildings, a small house that looks newer, complete with an American flag and a satellite dish. And then right in the middle of their yard is a marble monument.
It's a short obelisk, etched with the names of five white settlers who were killed here by Dakota men in August of 1862. This was the incident that started the U.S.-Dakota War. Gwen reads a steel plaque that was put up in the 1960s.
The Acton incident. On a bright Sunday afternoon, August 17, 1862, four young Sioux hunters, on a spur-of-the-moment dare, decided to prove their bravery by shooting Robinson Jones. Stopping at his cabin, they requested liquor and were refused. Then Jones, followed by the seemingly friendly Indians, went to the neighboring Howard Baker cabin, which stood on this site.
Here it's hard for me to picture the story this plaque tells. It says the Dakotas and the white men went to a neighbor's cabin, right here where the monument is now, and got into a target shooting contest. Maybe that's what people did with passing strangers on the frontier in 1862. Then the plaque says the Indians suddenly turned on the whites and shot three men and two women dead.
The Indians fled south to their village 40 miles away on the Minnesota River. There they reported what they had done, and the Sioux chiefs decided to wage an all-out war against the white man. Thus, the unplanned shooting of five settlers here at Acton triggered the bloody Sioux uprising of 1862. They decided to wage an all-out war against the white man.
You shook your head at that part.
I did. It's as if it were that there was nothing that led up to this. It leaves out so much. But it's a small monument. You can't get everything on there.
To get some of the story that's not on the sign, Gwen and I drive to a small museum. From the outside, it looks like one of those wayside rest buildings. It sits on a highway 15 miles north of Mankato, just outside the town where I went to college, St. Peter.
So this is our cleverly called intro room. But
Ben Leonard is tall and lanky. He heads the Nicollet County Historical Society and directs this museum, the Traverse des Sioux Treaty Site. The museum, with its big central room of maps and panels, gives the history that led to the 1862 war. First, the basics. The Dakota have lived in Minnesota for at least 1,000 years, and maybe a lot longer. They vastly outnumbered any Europeans who showed up until the mid-1800s, when white people started flooding in. And you can probably guess what happened next, because it happened all across the country. The country's leaders, going back to the founders, talked bluntly about prying land out of Indian hands. I'd never realized just how bluntly until talking to Ben. On the wall of the museum is the blown-up text from a letter I'd never seen. Thomas Jefferson wrote it in 1803.
Jefferson basically says, look, we want Indian land, but they're not just going to give it to us. So we have to motivate them to sign treaties, and the way that we do that is going to be to get them into debt.
All right, how did Jefferson really say that?
He said it here, the quote is here, to promote the disposition to exchange lands, we shall push our trading houses and be glad to see the good and influential individuals among them run in debt, because we observe that when these debts get beyond what individuals can pay, they are willing to lop them off by the cession of lands. So that's fairly matter of fact.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. That's what he said. Wow.
And that's exactly what happened in the Minnesota Territory. By 1851, the Dakota had come to rely on things they got from white traders: guns, food, horses, kettles and blankets, and traps. And because of some tough times and bad hunting seasons, they were deep in debt, at least according to the traders themselves, and they were the ones keeping track. Here's Gwen.
And the government calls them in again to say, we'll help you with your debt if you sell your land.
Ben, could you sort of sum up what was the deal essentially?
If you look at a map of Minnesota today, land-wise, we're talking about basically everything south of Interstate 94. So we're talking essentially about the lower half of Minnesota.
Plus some pieces of what would become Iowa and South Dakota. In two big treaties, one of them signed very near to the spot where the museum sits, the Dakota people traded away 35 million acres for about $3 million, which was a better price than some other tribes got. The treaties set aside a reservation for the Dakota, 10 miles on either side of the Minnesota River, stretching for 150 miles, a skinny strip in the middle of the vast territory the Dakota were giving up. They didn't have much choice. They could see what was coming from the east, a tidal wave of white settlers hungry for farmland. And the Dakota leaders essentially had a gun to their heads. The white negotiators didn't have to say it out loud, but one of them did anyway. A guy named Luke Lee reminded the Dakota chiefs that the U.S. government, quote, could come with 100,000 men and drive you off to the Rocky Mountains. A leading negotiator for the whites during these treaty deals was a man named Henry Sibley. He'll be a big part of this story. Nobody was more important in the creation of the state of Minnesota. He'd later become its first governor.
The treaty couldn't have happened without Henry Sibley.
To learn more about Sibley, I talked to this historian.
I'm Mary Wingard, and I wrote a book called North Country, The Making of Minnesota.
And it's pretty much the definitive history of Minnesota up to and including the U.S.-Dakota War, isn't it?
Well, I'm not going to say that. But yes, it is.
Wingard says Henry Sibley moved in from Detroit in the 1830s. He was just 23. The American Fur Company gave him a big job overseeing the southern half of what's now Minnesota. Sibley had a child with a Dakota woman. He understood the Dakota language. He went before Congress criticizing treaties that, quote, betrayed and deceived Indians.
And as a young man, he just relished spending his time with the Dakota, and he would go out and hunt with them and really fostered good relations with them. But the fur trade was a dying business. Was economically a dying business when he came here.
By this time, the region had been overhunted. Revenues were down. And everyone, from managers like Sibley to local traders on the frontier, down to the Dakota men who did the actual hunting, was in hock to the fur company, who had advanced them money for all the supplies, traps, and guns.
Even though he may seem to be the big man in Minnesota, he is buried in debt. By 1849, he was really looking around for some other way to make a living, but he couldn't get out of the trade until he could pay his debts. Because of his financial difficulties, he really played the Dakota people false. You know, Sibley wrote to Pierre Chouteau, who held most of Sibley's debt. He boasted to him, "The Indians are all prepared to make a treaty when we tell them to do so, and such a one as I may dictate. I think I may safely promise you that no treaty can be made without our claims being first secured."
Sibley and Chouteau said the Dakota owed them a lot of money. Those are the claims he's talking about. And they saw the treaties as a way to get paid. The way it happened was pretty ugly. Take the treaty signed in 1851 at Traverse des Sioux. The treaty was translated into the Dakota language for the chiefs to discuss, but their copy left out a key fact. The government wasn't going to give the Dakota their payment in a lump sum, as the Dakota wanted and expected. Instead, the money would stay in the hands of the government, to be doled out in much smaller annual payments, not just in gold, but also food and things like farming equipment. The treaty did provide $305,000 in cash right away, so 15,000 Dakota people could get through the first winter on the reservation and, quote-unquote, settle their affairs. After the signing of the treaty, Sibley's allies took the chiefs aside to sign a second document. The chiefs later said they thought it was just another copy of the treaty, but in fact they were agreeing to hand over most of that $305,000 to the traders, all but $60,000, to settle their debts. So the traders got their money. Sibley himself walked away with $66,000, more than the Dakota people got in the initial cash payment. Again, Mary Wingard.
That cleared him. That cleared his debts. That allowed him to get out of the trade. He has to know, you know, what he's doing. When he is faced with a moral dilemma of deal fairly with these people who have been my friends, or take advantage of this opportunity to get out of this situation that I hate, he chooses his own self-interest.
You're listening to Little War on the Prairie by documentary producer John Bewin. If you tuned in late or would like to hear it again, it is archived at nprnews.org.
Did you get a trail map or anything like that when you came in?
No, I didn't.
We have some in there.
Gwen Westerman and I have driven west out on the prairie for the next bit of the story, the build-up to the war. We've come to the Lower Sioux Agency. This was the federal government's outpost on Dakota land, near Redwood Falls, Minnesota. Sioux was the white man's name for the Dakota.
Oh, yeah, my name's Anthony Morris. I'm a ninth generation Lower Sioux Metawakaton. My family's been here for at least 150 years. We actually have a picture of my seven-times great-grandfather in the museum here. And I have
Morris is just 26. He wears glasses and a wispy beard. He directs the historic site. The government's two-story stone warehouse is still here, surrounded by open grassland. In 1862, it was stocked with government food shipments for distribution to the Dakota. These were paid out once a year under the terms of the treaty.
Okay, so in 1862, they're coming off a bad crop year in 1861. There's a lot of bad feelings that are kind of brewing. They're really waiting for that annuity payment in June. They're waiting for their food and gold. The local area here would really look about like it would right now.
The annual federal shipment of gold and food promised in the 1851 treaty did not arrive on schedule in June. July passed, and it didn't come. In the decade since the Dakota signed away their land, Minnesota had become a state. The white population exploded from 5,000 in 1850 to more than 170,000. Put another way, in 1850, Indians outnumbered whites in Minnesota 5-1. By 1860, it was the other way around. And the Dakota were being squeezed into less and less space. Washington changed the terms of those 1851 treaties, took half the reservation back, and forced them to accept the new terms. This didn't go down well. Minnesota's leaders thought everything would be fine if the Dakota would just give up hunting, which required lots of land, and take up farming. Some did, cut their hair, raised crops. But as you'd expect, not everyone wanted to. Dakota men had always been hunters. Farming was seen as women's work. Hemmed in on their skinny reservation, lots of people couldn't feed themselves. By that August, things were desperate.
They were allowing their children to eat the unripened fruit off the trees because they had to eat something. However, this unripened fruit would then make them sick. They would be even worse, and some people would end up dying because of these problems.
Meanwhile, the federal agent had food in the warehouse, but he refused to give it out to the Dakota until their full June payment arrived. Dakota men confronted a storekeeper named Andrew Myrick, asking him for help or credit. What do you expect us to feed our families?
And he said to let him eat grass. He considered them basically like livestock. They were considered animals to him. And
there are some versions of that story that say Andrew Myrick said, let them eat grass or their own dung.
Yep.
In 200 years, there hadn't been much violence between Indians and whites in Minnesota. But in August of 1862, Dakota country was ready to blow up. Maybe the only question was, where would the spark come from? That brings us back to the part of the story where Gwen and I began, in that farmyard in Acton, where the four young Dakota men killed the five settlers. There are other versions of the story, one from a Dakota who spoke with the four young men, that don't include the Dakota men asking for liquor or the target shooting contest. In this version, the Dakotas were coming back from a hunting trip and they were frustrated and hungry. The story ends the same, though, with five settlers dead.
After the Acton massacre, the four boys, they rode back to the Lower Sioux Agency. That's where their village was located. They went back to their chief and relayed to him what they had done in Acton.
This is Anthony Morse again.
And so their chief called a meeting with more chiefs, and they eventually called a council with all of the chiefs of Lower Sioux at one of Little Crow's houses, I believe. There they had their council on what they should do.
Little Crow was one of the leaders who signed the 1851 treaty that turned out so badly for the Dakota. When the chiefs and some riled up young men showed up at his house in the middle of the night, Little Crow said the white world would come down hard on all the Dakota, not just the four men who'd been at Acton. A lot of the young warriors said the Dakota should attack first. Enough is enough. Let's drive the whites out. But Little Crow wanted no part of that. He'd been to Washington, D.C. In those days, the government liked to invite American Indian leaders to the capital to show them how powerful the new white man's country was. Gwen Westerman, my traveling companion, is related to Little Crow. Like I said, her great-great-great-great-grandmother was the chief's sister. She says Little Crow, whose name in Dakota is Ta'oyate-Duta, was one of many Dakota trying to adjust to the white culture and find a place in it.
And at this time, Ta'oyate-Duta was living in a house and farming.
And going to church.
Had cut his hair. And he was trying to establish a homestead here because this is Dakota homeland, in the hopes, I think, of being able to stay here.
At first, when the young men started calling for war, what was Ta'oyate-Duta's reaction, his take?
No, we can't fight. We have a responsibility to stay on this land and to live. And he knew that if the Dakota went to war against the United States, that all of that effort would be lost.
Everyone argued about what to do. Little Crow made a speech that his son, years later, recited to a lawyer who had it translated and written down. We asked an actor to read it.
Braves, you're like little children. You know not what you are doing. See, the white men are like the locusts when they fly so thick that the whole sky is a snowstorm. You may kill 1, 2, 10, yes, as many as the leaves in the forest yonder, and their brothers will not miss them. Kill 1, 2, 10, and 10 times 10 will come to kill you. Yes, they fight among themselves, a way off.
He's talking about the Civil War going on to the southeast.
Yes, they fight among themselves. But if you strike at them, they will all turn on you and devour you and your women and little children.
The young warriors call Little Crow a coward. His response.
Taliatedutta is not a coward, and he is not a fool. When did he run away from his enemies? You are fools. Braves, you are little children. You will die like the rabbits when the hungry wolves hunt them in the hard moon. Taliatedutta is not a coward. He will die with you.
Most of Little Crow's band, along with men from other Dakota bands, decided to go to war. Historian Mary Wingard calls the fighters a group of rash young men. She says this is a crucial point that's often missed when the story of the conflict is told in Minnesota.
It is a complete myth that all the Dakota people went to war against the United States. That's why I have a little bit of trouble with calling it a war, actually. I know that that is the preferred terminology now, but they would get the idea that all the Dakota agreed that they were going to go to war the way the United States would go to war, but in fact, of course, that wasn't the case. You know, it was a faction that went on the offensive, and many people, particularly the Sisseton's and Wahpeton's, were opposed and wanted no part of it.
Many men in those two bands did not fight. Over the coming weeks, the war and peace factions had angry debates and almost went to war with each other. Gwen Westerman tells me her own family was split, and she's not sure who did the right thing.
One of my three great-grandfathers in 1862 was with Sweet Corn's band out on the prairie hunting buffalo. Another of my three great-grandfathers was Mazamani, who was killed at the battle at Wood Lake. Another of my three great-grandfathers was Ishtachba, or Sleepy Eye, who didn't want to fight at all. You know, the decisions that people made that allowed them to survive so that I could stand here today, you can't second-guess those.
So the morning after Little Crow's speech, and after the murders at the Acton Farm, August 18, 1862, several hundred Dakota warriors, led by Little Crow, started their assault at the federal outpost that sat on their land, the Lower Sioux Agency. They took food from the stone warehouse, burned buildings, and killed about 20 men, one-fourth of the whites at the agency. The dead included the storekeeper who said that if Dakota families were hungry, they could eat grass. Again, Anthony Morse, who runs the agency's history center.
Andrew Myrick's body was found. He was more than likely fleeing from his home to the tall grass and the trees. However, he didn't quite make it, and his body was found filled with arrows and with grass stuffed in his mouth.
Most of Minnesota's trained soldiers were off at the Civil War. When word of the attacks reached a nearby fort, some green, unprepared soldiers came to help. The Dakota ambushed them, killing almost everyone and sending the rest fleeing for their lives. From there, the Dakota men fanned out down the river valley, attacking the homes of settlers, most of them unarmed. Joseph Godfrey was a young black man who lived among the Dakota. He testified later that fall, telling how Dakota warriors he was with went house to house. This is an actor reading.
Dinner was on the table, and the Indian said, "After we kill, then we will have dinner." When we got near to a house, the Indians all got out and ran ahead of the wagons, and two or three went to each house. And in that way, they killed all the people along the road.
Some Dakota killed every settler they saw. Others killed only the men and took women and children captive. But many Dakota warriors spared and protected white people they knew. Even Chief Little Crow, the leader of the uprising, allowed a white woman named Sarah Wakefield, the wife of a local doctor, to take shelter in his house during the 6 weeks of the war. The historian Mary Wingard is a fifth-generation Minnesotan. She says for 100 years or more, Minnesotans who heard the story at all heard a one-sided tale of savage Indians attacking innocent whites out of the blue. Now, most historians like herself blame the war mainly on white double-dealing and bullying.
But I also think it's a mistake to try to pretend that there was no wrongs committed by the men who rode against the settlers. A minimum 400 innocent civilians were murdered, most of them who didn't even have weapons, women and children. The Dakota people were victims big time. But most of the people who died were victims as well. The people who would have been worthy opponents in a war were untouchable.
Meaning the men in St. Paul and Washington, D.C., who wrote, then violated the treaties. The fighting lasted 36 days. Dakota warriors attacked New Ulm twice and looted and burned a couple other towns. White settlers turned into panicked refugees, fleeing across the prairie. And the man appointed to lead a force to defeat the Dakota? Henry Sibley. You remember Sibley, the fur trader and now former governor, who helped orchestrate the treaties of 1851.
Well, Sibley has no military experience whatsoever. But he does know the Dakota well, and he knows what great warriors they are. And he has the most, you know, hodgepodge troops ever, and he doesn't have enough weaponry. And so he's moving very slowly towards southwestern Minnesota. And of course, every step of the way, the newspapers are excoriating him.
They called him a snail and a coward and the state undertaker because Sibley's militia showed a knack for arriving after battles were over to help bury the dead.
So Sibley, with his very thin skin, is beside himself. And I think that that helps explain the really extraordinarily severe attitude he had toward all the Dakota people following the conflict. I really think it was because he felt he was personally betrayed.
Sibley had seen himself as a friend to the Dakota. He believed they could take up farming and coexist with white people in Minnesota. But now even some Dakota he knew, men who had started to assimilate, were murdering settlers. In his letters, Sibley was bitter. Quote, "A great public crime has been committed, not by wild Indians who did not know better, but by men who have had advantages, intercourse with white men." In another, he wrote, "Tame the Indian, cultivate him, strive to Christianize him as you will, and the sight of blood will in an instant call out the savage, wolfish, devilish instincts in his race." Years before all this, Sibley had warned that if the federal government kept cheating Indians in treaties, the result would be war. Now that very thing was happening in his own state, and he himself had helped convince the Indians to sign those crooked treaties. Altogether in the six-week war, somewhere between 400 and 1,000 white people died, most of them settlers. Not as many Dakota died, maybe 50 to 100 in the war itself. But payback was still to come.
Our course then is plain. The Sioux Indians of Minnesota must be exterminated or driven forever beyond the borders of the state.
This is what Minnesota Governor Alexander Ramsey, Henry Sibley's successor, said to a special session of the state legislature during the war in September of 1862.
If any shall escape extinction, the wretched remnant must be driven beyond our borders and our frontier garrisoned with a force sufficient to forever prevent their return.
It's not surprising that white Minnesotans were enraged by the attacks, but things got extreme. A newspaper columnist named Jane Gray Swiss Elm called for a bounty for Sioux scalps, and months later the state started offering $75 each and eventually $200. Chief Little Crow and a couple hundred of the most militant warriors had fled west, out of Minnesota. The rest of the Dakota people gathered voluntarily at a makeshift camp on the prairie to wait for Colonel Henry Sibley. Most were women, children, and old men who had not participated in the killing. Here's Gwen again.
There are letters back and forth between Henry Sibley and the leaders on the Dakota side where he specifically said, you know, come out under a flag of truce, you'll be protected. I'll protect you. You have my word.
And like some other promises that have been made along the way.
That one was not honored either.
The Dakota trusted Sibley's promise that only those who had murdered settlers would be punished. But the 1,700 Dakota civilians were marched 150 miles down the Minnesota River, a mini trail of tears. In towns along the way, white people attacked them with rocks, clubs, and knives. A half-Dakota man named Samuel Brown was along for the march, working for the government. He wrote in his diary that in the town of Henderson, a white woman grabbed a baby from a Dakota woman's arms and threw it at the ground, killing the baby. The Dakota walked for a week, says historian Mary Wingard, until they reached their destination near St. Paul.
What was essentially a concentration camp at Fort Snelling, where they were kept until the spring of 1863, and then they were transported to a reservation, Crow Creek, South Dakota. It was in Dakota Territory, which was the next best thing to hell. And the death toll was just shocking.
Hundreds of Dakota, mostly children and old people, died of disease over the winter in Fort Snelling. About 100 more died on boats that took them down the Mississippi and up the Missouri to Dakota Territory. Still more hundreds died at the South Dakota Reservation. As Wingard puts it, this was the thanks most of the Dakota got for opposing the war.
You're listening to Little War on the Prairie by documentary producer John Bewin. If you tuned in late or would like to hear the program again, it is archived at nprnews.org.
Okay, I'm just going to get some sound of the wind here.
On our travels, this is Gwen Westerman and me again in Mankato, my hometown, where she now teaches at the State University. It's windy, but otherwise a nice day in October. We're in an old park, a favorite place of mine. Big trees with bright yellow leaves, picnic tables. Alongside the park, the Blue Earth River that I canoed on as a kid flows into the Minnesota River.
And it was right down here on this sandy riverbank that my family used to build a fire and roast hot dogs and marshmallows and sit out here at night and have just a lovely time on a fall night like this.
We should have brought hot dogs.
This is where the Dakota men ended up, the ones who turned themselves in after Henry Sibley promised to treat them fairly. Sibley set up a kangaroo court out on the prairie and tried 400 of them in a few weeks. He didn't let the Dakota have lawyers or witnesses. Some trials lasted 5 minutes. He named a panel of 5 U.S. soldiers who had just been fighting against the Dakota to hand out verdicts and death sentences. Sibley's court condemned 303 Dakota men. A report was sent to President Lincoln on the plan to hang all of them. The president, fresh off the bloodiest day in American history at Antietam, was stunned by the long list. He ordered the Minnesotans to hold off on the hangings until his office could review the trial transcripts. So they waited right here. They called it Camp Lincoln.
And you can imagine teepees and fires and tents, soldiers. So a lot of people don't know that that's what was here. Or they think of Camp Lincoln was near here. We don't know where. Or they don't think about it at all.
I can tell you that growing up, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Never heard of Camp Lincoln.
For me and most people in Mankato, this was just Sibley Park. That's right, Sibley Park. Named after the man who led the charge to shove the Dakota off their homeland to make way for, well, people like me. There's a Henry Sibley High School in the Twin Cities. Sibley County is just up the road from Mankato. In Washington, in the fall of 1862, President Lincoln was getting heated messages from the governor and others in Minnesota. They said he'd better allow the hanging of the 303 Dakota men, or else furious white people might go vigilante. Lynch mobs formed in Mankato and other towns and had to be quelled by soldiers. Newspapers told horrifying stories that Dakota warriors had mutilated babies and raped countless settler women, though very few of those claims were ever backed up. President Lincoln wired back to Minnesota.
And so Lincoln says, okay, so the ones who ought to be put to death are the ones who raped women. So go through these cases and identify the ones who are guilty of violating women. And as it turns out, they can only find two cases of rape.
And hanging two Indians would not satisfy the people of Minnesota, the president was told. So Lincoln had his people review the trial transcripts for evidence that the men had attacked settlers and not just shown up at battles. In the end, Lincoln himself wrote out a list of 39 Dakota names, later trimmed to 38. The day after Christmas, those men were marched onto a big platform in Mankato's town square. Hoods were pulled over their heads. 4,000 people had come from miles around to watch. The men held each other's hands and sang prayers till the moment the floor under them dropped away. They fell, and the chanting stopped. No photographs of the hangings have ever been found, but engravings were reproduced on souvenir spoons and beer trays. Little Crow was shot 6 months after the hangings, and his scalp, skull, and wrist bones were displayed at the Minnesota Historical Society for decades. Mary Wingard says for a short time after the war, Minnesotans were triumphant at having beaten back the savage Indians. They relished the story.
So there's lots of dime novels coming out and panoramas that are created, and the whole country is fascinated and mesmerized by this horrible thing that happened. Well, it doesn't take people in Minnesota very long to figure out afterwards, this is really, really bad PR. This is not good. And how will we encourage people to come to Minnesota if they think they're going to be scalped the minute they step out of their cabin?
So she says Minnesotans clammed up about the nastiness of 1862. Instead, they embraced a gauzy, fantastical version of the state's Indian heritage. So does that help explain how I could grow up in Minnesota 100 years later, in Mankato even, and not hear anything about all this history?
Well, yes, I think that explains a good part of it. I think people of your generation and my generation never really felt that Indians were really part of the past of this place, that they were stories like Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox.
Today, visitors to Minneapolis can drive down Hiawatha Boulevard and visit Minnehaha Falls, references to Longfellow's romanticized poem, Song of Hiawatha. Countless Minnesota businesses use native names and imagery. Land O'Lakes Butter, with its Indian maiden on the box. There's a Little Crow Country Club. For years, the logo of the gas company, Minnegasco, was an Indian girl with a blue flame as the feather in her headdress. There are probably other reasons white Minnesotans don't spend much time remembering the U.S.-Dakota War. I suspect one big one is, we won. Mary Wingard and Gwen Westerman both say they routinely meet students who've grown up in the area and arrive at college with no knowledge of the Dakota War, never heard of it. But things have changed since I was a kid, Every sixth grader in Minnesota is now supposed to learn about the war, at least a little. It's a week-long unit in the state's Minnesota history textbook. Back home in Mankato this fall, I met a teacher who spends twice as much time because of the local connection.
All right. Join me on page 122 if you're not there. This is a great picture.
Elizabeth Zarn teaches at Garfield Elementary.
I think a lot of the students are shocked. I think they really are. Basically, what it boils down to, that people would treat each other like that, no matter race, culture, or creed.
Yeah. So the rest of the land they just took over?
Yeah. Rachel just said, does that mean the rest of the land they just took over? Who's they?
The people that traveled from Europe, maybe?
Yeah, the U.S. government. The U.S. government took it over, then the Europeans started to come in, and they started to use this as farmland.
And to have these things happen so close to home, it's a little tough to swallow, I think, and I think they're shocked.
In addition to sixth grade history, every third grader in Mankato goes to a powwow in September that's devoted to education and reconciliation between Dakota and non-Dakota people. But still, the quality of the teaching varies.
So show me you're prepared.
Monroe Elementary is just across the Minnesota River from the hanging site. Patricia Hammond is prepping her third grade class for the powwow. I asked her how she presents the War of 1862, standing with her in front of her students.
We just talked about, like, a conflict is a disagreement. And we talked how the Dakota Indians didn't know how to solve their conflicts, and the only way they knew how to solve their disagreements was to fight, which we know we don't fight when we solve conflicts. We use our words. But that was their only way that they knew how to solve a conflict. They fought. And so then the white settlers needed to fight back to protect themselves. And we talked about people were killed. And then we talked about how the Dakota Indians were, which we call.
My guess is that no Dakota children were in the room to take offense. In 1863, Congress passed a law confiscating all the Dakotas' land in Minnesota. President Lincoln signed it, effectively banishing the Dakota from the state. About 25 years later, Congress allowed some Dakota who were considered friendly to return and establish small settlements in the state. So today, four Dakota communities are dotted across southern Minnesota. But for Gwen and all the other Dakota who grew up elsewhere, the federal expulsion from Minnesota, their homeland, is still on the books.
How everything's going to go is no walkers go past here.
This past August, to mark the 150th anniversary of the start of the U.S.-Dakota War, a symbolic walk home organized by several Dakota bands and reservations. Gwen and I went.
While we're standing here today, in the midst of cornfields, on all sides of this intersection, under an incredibly beautiful blue sky, at the state line between South Dakota and Minnesota, as we make that walk back into Minnesota 150 years after we were forced to leave.
The Highway Patrol has closed off a section of road where South Dakota's Highway 34 meets Minnesota Highway 30. There are a dozen Dakota on horseback and many more on foot. A handful of white Minnesotans greet them with signs saying, "Welcome home."
Thank you. Thank you for coming back. Thank you.
About 40 yards shy of the state line.
That's about as far as I can let you guys go.
Organizers ask reporters to turn off our equipment if we want to witness the ceremony up close. Maybe 100 people form a big circle around 8 older Dakota women. They pass eagle feathers across the line into Minnesota and sweep sage smoke on themselves. There are prayers and tears.
I have a much different response than I had anticipated. And I think it started yesterday when they told us that Governor Dayton had declared today a day of remembrance and reconciliation, and that he repudiated Governor Ramsey's words about extermination and exile.
Minnesota's governor, Mark Dayton, said he was appalled by Governor Ramsey's words in 1862. Dayton stated flatly that the U.S. used deception and force to take Indian lands and broke its promises.
And when I heard that, it was kind of overwhelming in a way that I hadn't anticipated, because I thought it would be, yes, you know, it's about time, or I don't know. But that's not the way it felt. It was relief. It was an overwhelming feeling, and I wanted to cry, but I was in a restaurant, and I was glad I had sunglasses on, so I held it together then. But about 2 weeks ago, I was given a presentation at the Minnesota Historical Society, and during the question session, somebody said, well, you know, what do you want? Do you want reparations? And the person who asked the question was almost accusatory. Well, what do you want? What more do you want? And I said, what we want is acknowledgement that this happened. And so to hear what the governor did, this is a turning point. You know, we want to be acknowledged. And here it is.
During this 150th anniversary year, there may have been more said in Minnesota about the 1862 war than in the last 100 years combined. Lots of broadcasts, newspaper articles, and talks in historical societies. The history of every place is more complicated than the people who live there like to believe. And every moment in history is just as complex as the moment we're living in right now. I have a friend, Tim Tyson, a historian at Duke, who points out that in his home state of North Carolina, up to one-third of the white people were pro-Union during the Civil War. And a year into the war, 1862, the state elected a governor who'd opposed both slavery and secession.
And yet there's no memory that white people opposed the Civil War. There's no memory that, you know, General Pickett of Pickett's Charge came to Kinston, North Carolina in 1864. And the first thing he did was he hanged 22 local white boys on the courthouse lawn because they were loyal to the United States government. And you go down to Kinston now, and you go out to King's Barbecue, and you look down the row of cars at all those trucks and all those Confederate flag bumper stickers. And I just want to say, you don't know who you are. They hanged your great-granddaddy, and you got their flag on your bumper. That's kind of interesting. So we invent a fake history for ourselves that doesn't deal with the complexities. And I think in some ways that's what the South and the Upper Midwest have in common, is that there's a delusion at work about who we were. And that's why we have a hard time about who we are. So that the kind of self-congratulatory history that it passes for heritage, it keeps us from seeing ourselves and doing better.
One more place to see fake history: on the state flag of Minnesota. The image on the flag is the state seal. It shows a white farmer behind a plow tilling the soil. He's looking up to watch an Indian man ride past on a horse. The seal was redesigned in 1983, changing the direction of the Indian. So he's now riding almost toward the farmer, like a neighbor passing by. In the original seal, though, adopted by the first governor, Henry Sibley, the Indian is literally riding away into the sunset. He looks back at the white man. As far as you can tell, he's leaving willingly.
Thank you.
Little War on the Prairie was produced for Minnesota Public Radio News by John Bewin, director of the audio program at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and edited by Mike Edgerly. It is adapted from a story that was originally broadcast on This American Life, which is produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by Public Radio International. This program is available for listening anytime at nprnews.org. And there are a lot of great photos from events in 1862 and events in 2012 on our website at nprnews.org. Another thing to tell you about, you can watch a live discussion about teaching the U.S. Dakota War of 1862 in Minnesota schools and participate in an online forum at 4 p.m. on Wednesday. That's tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on nprnews.org.